Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I am joined by Sarah Jane Bentley and Matt Bianco. Sarah Jane, Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, David. Good to be here.
Glad as always.
So we are here to answer listener questions about The Rector of Justice. We have talked our way through the novel, and here we are one final time to discuss Louis Auchincloss's... Should we call him Louis? I feel like we should call him Louis for this episode. Lou?
What's Big the, Lou.
Yeah, Big Lou.
Big Lou.
Yeah. What's the most disrespectful thing we can call him? Before we get into our conversation surrounding your questions, I want to remind everybody that you can get in touch and send questions for... Well, this book, if you'd like, although we want to answer them on the air, or future books by joining the conversation on the Close Reads podcast discussion group on Facebook, following us on Instagram at Close Reads Pods, or emailing us at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. Most of the questions for this book actually came in through the Facebook thread. I don't think I got any by email this time for the first time in a long time. So I've pulled up the Facebook group here and I'm going to just kind of scroll down. Some of these we will do, as is customary, a little bit sort of rapid fire style, and some we'll dig into pretty deeply.
What is the purpose of these? Is it stump the hosts? Are they trying to stump us? Is that why we weren't supposed to see the questions?
Well,
in advance,
they do that sometimes. You know, people out there like to get clever and cute and try to stump us. But as it turns out, history suggests that we are, generally speaking, an unstumpable group of people. So,
dang.
The great thing about it is that I'm the moderator who takes the questions and asks them of the two of you. And so I can say that with very little risk.
But you have to answer them too, surely, David.
Surely.
Come on. That's what listeners want, really, is the David Kern take.
Yeah. Well, we're going to test that theory in this episode. This first question comes from Sarah.
Wait, not Sarah.
Not
Jane.
Sarah Jane. No, Sarah.
That's tricky. I didn't know we could do that.
Although I can't prove that her middle name is not Jane. Her name is Sarah Montgomery, longtime listener. She's got that little coffee mug icon next to her name. So she's a, what do they call that? A
conversation starter.
She's a conversation starter on the Facebook group. And although she didn't start this thread, she did ask a question. She asks, we know that Jules Grimes committed suicide, but does anyone else feel that Jules' story is incomplete? Did I miss clues about the period between his visit with Prescott in jail and his death? Nicole, also a conversation
Grissom?
Starter. Yes. Grissom. Yeah. Sorry. There was a typo there and my brain didn't correct it as I was reading the question. Matt, what do you think about this?
I got caught up on the last name. What's the actual question?
Okay. Yeah. Right. Jules Grissom. Yeah. I just kind of blindly kept reading. We know that Jules Grissom committed suicide, but does anyone else feel that Jules' story is incomplete? That I miss clues about the period between his visit with Prescott in jail and his death. And Nicole also said, I wondered if I missed something too. I didn't go back to check. What do you guys think about this? Matt, I'll let you answer this one first.
I don't think they missed anything. If they did, then I missed it too.
Okay, so that part of the question, you have not been stumped.
Yes. Score one for me. So
I've got a little tally here. We're going to see.
Excellent.
What is it? Stump the chump? What's the NPR thing?
Why did it get so competitive all of a sudden?
I don't know. American thing. Are English people competitive?
No, I'm terrible. I'm really competitive.
All right. Perfect. This is going to be the best show.
Don't encourage me.
I think my guess is that Jules has chosen to define himself as anti-Prescott. And so there's not really much to tell us about Jules except for when he's being anti-Prescott. And it's almost like everything that gets skipped or left out of the story, it would be just more anti-Prescott stuff because that just seems who he is. But maybe that's just because that's all we've gotten and that there was another side and we just never got to see it.
Hmm.
then again, what's his face? Brian is telling the Prescott story. So the only parts of Jules' story that would be appropriate would be the Prescott stories, which of course are all anti-Prescott, right?
Hmm.
I mean, they're all Prescott stories that define Jules as being the anti-Prescott.
Sarah Jane, do you want to add to this?
Yeah. So is Sarah, our listener, concerned that there's something happening after the end of Jules Griscom's memoir that she's missed as a reader? Is that kind of, have I got the right sense of the question there?
I think there's this sort of a sense of, she says that the story feels incomplete. So maybe she feels like there is supposed to be something that explains why he ultimately does commit suicide.
Yeah.
More than just that visit. Like no one comes, you know, we don't get anything from David Griscom. We don't get anything from his father. We don't get anything from, our narrator. We don't get anything from, Prescott himself commenting on, or very little anyway, right, commenting right on that ultimate sort of, his ultimate, you know, Jules's demise. And so I wonder if perhaps it leaves it feeling like there's a suggestion that Prescott, because of Prescott, Jules, you know, drives off the cliff or whatever.
Well, I think one thing we're dealing with in the novel is that we're given a sort of finite account from Jules Griscom, which is handed to Brian by Dave. So in that sense, that's all that Brian has to work with in his in his memoir. Mm. So that is, it is complete in that sense, insofar as that's what Jules had written. And we get to the end of that at the end of chapter 19. And then I think the only thing we hear about Jules after that are sort of Prescott's reflections on Jules and how Jules is his greatest failure. So there is an ellipsis there. But isn't it similar to what Matt was saying, is that part of Jules' life is not significant in shedding light on Prescott in any way? Is he in America when he dies, Jules? Or I've got this sense that he was in France. Maybe I just imagined that.
Mm.
I can't remember. But there's a kind of,
I have to go back and check,
shadiness
on that
surrounding his suicide as well, because he's drink driving, isn't he, with a girl in the passenger seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, I suppose that is suicidal behavior, but there's a little bit of ambiguity about that in itself, isn't there? And that there's a kind of an accidental nature to a car crash.
That was going to be my follow-up question. I'm not sure that there's, I don't recall them saying it specifically was suicide right? So much as you say, suicidal behavior. Although it seemed like there was an implication that he had a sort of, you know, death wish, like a character from Hemingway.
Yes, like, or that, even from The Great Gatsby, you know, where something like wealthy people, they smash up against other people. And I can't remember the quotation from Gatsby, but it's something like that, about them being careless drivers.
So English people do read American novels when they're not forced to.
I've read The Great Gatsby several times.
Jane's not English.
Well, true. She's Welsh. Yeah, true.
I love American novels. I've read loads of them.
Okay. This next question comes from Holly. And she asks,
Sarah Jane does get a point for that, by the way.
Oh, true. True. I'll tally for each.
Only one point. I answered both parts of the question.
Okay. So I do have, so we got to decide this. Am I giving a tally for just not being stumped? Or if there's a multi-part question, is it like one of those shows where just the host just gets to give tallies, like one of those ESPN sports shows where they get to debate each other and however he's feeling in the moment, he just gives a bunch of, he presses a button and it goes ding, ding, ding.
We need some of those button sound effects, I feel.
We do. Maybe Logan can drop something in after the fact for us to make it sound like we know what we're doing ahead of time. This next
That was your cue, Logan.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, he's going to be dropping in like, you know, like nonsense sound effects now.
Cartoon boings.
Yeah, exactly. All right. This next question, as I said, is from Holly. And she says, throughout the reading of how the school functioned, I kept thinking of Charlotte Mason and the principle that all children are born persons. It felt like the school was a bit utilitarian in that everyone was expected to become a certain way, social, athletic, etc. If the principle of children being born persons had been applied, would Prescott have failed Jules? Am I wrong in reading this school as trying to produce a similar person, many miniature Prescotts, she held in parentheses, of each of its students, instead of trying to cultivate each with his unique gifts? And then she says, she adds, oh, and I agree that none of the women rang true to me, especially Cordelia. If Harriet was a true Parisian and lover of the arts, wouldn't she also have the elegant simplicity the French women are known for instead of being plain? So I guess Holly is giving you a little ding there, Sarah Jane.
I'll take that. Thank you, Holly.
Yeah, and a mark against me.
Yeah. we can touch on that again if we need to. So Charlotte Mason and the principle of that all children are born persons, is this school trying to produce similar people, similar persons, those being many miniature Prescotts? Sarah Jane, I'll let you take this one first.
I think Holly is onto something there. And I recall we discussed it a little bit, maybe it was last week, when Matt said that there were some similarities between Dave Griscom and Prescott. Because Prescott accuses Griscom of wanting that for the school, that if Dave Griscom was in control, he would create a load of Dave Griscom models. So, yeah, I do think there's a sort of archetypal Justinian, that's the right word, isn't it? Which conforms to some of the principles and perhaps even the role model of Prescott himself. Whereas Charlotte Mason, I suppose, is more into the idea of education as a leading out of the soul, of discovering what seed is already planted there and nurturing that individuality. So I think there is a conflict there. I suppose the difficulty with a character like Jules is that there are a lot of weeds growing in that particular bed, aren't there? So I don't know what Charlotte Mason would say about that, but if... presumably you have to encourage the virtuous aspects of a character and weed out the bad ones. And I think that is what Prescott tries to do. But with any of these big institutions, there is a kind of institutional stereotype or archetype that results. And I often get asked that actually about the school I work in, you know, what kind of boy does it produce? What's the typical Etonian? What are the traits? And
the typical, yeah.
Yeah. So I think I agree with Holly that maybe there are problems with this kind of schooling. But when you're schooling en masse like this, rather than homeschooling as a mother, then certain compromises have to be made. And there's kind of a structure that gets imposed in a way.
Mm. Matt, she mentioning this, the sort of concept of sort of archetypal standards, or... the word typical came up, but I'm going to focus on her comment there, but Sarah Jane's comment about archetypal standards. Is that, do you think, counter to the concept of people being born persons and cultivating virtues in individual people? Because on the one hand, when you talk about an archetypal standard, you're sort of talking about something to work towards. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that you can do that. You can have that as a sort of guiding light or something to you know, both appeal to and work towards, and still recognize the individuality of individual people, so to speak. So do you think that in this school that it's leaning too heavily on those archetypal standards as models, and thus that's one of the reasons why there's failures of Prescott has failures with people like Jules?
Yeah, I agree with that, with your premise there, that there's an archetype or archetypal standards that are necessary for education.
I get a point. Okay. Yeah.
that's what we're driving towards, right? Like to be human, to be a man, to be an adult, to be whatever. And I think what Charlotte Mason does that's really helpful for us is help us to remember that there's a personality, a personhood to it that's not swallowed up by the archetype, that remains as you're pursuing the archetype. And, you know, I maybe just as an example, right? Like there are all kinds of dogs, German shepherds and Australian shepherds and chihuahuas. And if chihuahuas are in fact dogs, I'm not sure. and Bichons and whatever. There's all these different kinds of dogs, and all of them participate. All of them have the archetype of dogness, but then they all have their kind of individual. In this case, there's what do you call those
breeds,
the individual breeds, but then like even within a breed, right? An individual dog has a personality that's different from the other dogs, and yet they're all still dogs, right? But then we can see what a dog looks like when it's not being properly dog. And that's, you know, the one living in the alley of a city eating trash and you know, attacking passersby. It's not appropriately a dog. Anyways, so I think the problem here with Frank's school is that he has confused individual characteristics and traits with the archetype of what a man is. He's got a boys' school and he wants those boys to grow up to be men, but he's not moving them toward an archetypal man or the archetypal man. He's moving them towards this idea of a man that he has, which assumes too much with respect to particular characteristics and qualities and personality traits, his own, I think. And so then it doesn't allow room for a different kind of personality like that, that in his mind, I think in the Justinian situation, that person isn't truly a man. The one that doesn't like playing football, the one that doesn't, you know, whatever. And so those people get lost because they can't be themselves and still be men, or in this case, Prescott's, right? But in Frank's defense, I think he does outgrow that tendency.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right? Like what happens in his relationship with Brian, I think is him seeing that Brian can or is indeed a man, even though, I mean, he has some growing himself that he has to do, but it doesn't undercut Brian's personality the way maybe he tried to do with Jules or in some of the other boys. Does that make sense?
What about the idea that Brian essentially does follow a similar route to Prescott, in that he goes to theological college and then goes and teaches at Dustin Martyr? That's sort of what Prescott hopes for him, isn't it? And that's what he guides him towards. So there is a sense in which Brian becomes a bit of a Prescott in some ways.
Yeah, and go ahead, Matt. You going to say something? You look like you're on the verge.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what I was going to say, because I mean, I agree. Like there's the similarities between the path that he takes and where he ends up, but his personality is not abolished.
I was thinking about that one towards the end of the book, because I was thinking about, in some ways, it seems like Prescott sees Brian as, you know, another chance to mentor somebody, but also somebody who is similar to him, who he can, you know, he can kind of say, follow in my footsteps to some degree, but who also is different enough that he might not be as hard and harsh in the ways that he was. Almost like it's like a second chance for him to sort of correct some things, that some mistakes that he made, to help somebody not make the same mistakes as he did. It seems like that's part of the reason why he treats him almost like a son or like another student. He really invests in him. He gives him the kind of time that you might give a mentee, you know. Just seems like they have that sort of relationship. And he's very, you know, in a way that he's not sort of one person with him all the time. Sometimes he's blustery and frustrating. And sometimes he's very gentle and kind and speaks, you know, very...
Frank, you mean?
Yeah, towards Brian, yeah. And then sometimes he's, you know, sometimes he's very... He's sort of like a sage. And sometimes he's like a blustery old man, you know?
Right.
And at the end, he's even a bit vulnerable, isn't he?
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, Frank makes that distinction between the students, where there were some that he was kind to because it was easy to be kind to them, or maybe not kind is the word, but I think there was some that he liked because it was easy to like them. And then the one boy that dies, right? He laments the fact that he wasn't good to that boy because that boy wasn't charismatic enough to make him have to be, treat him a certain way, right? Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yes. The it's one of the boys who isn't as charming or as charismatic as Charlie, but is also one of his prefects.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's the distinction, right? There was he behaved one way toward Charlie because Charlie was charismatic, and another way toward this boy that died in the war because he wasn't charismatic. So why does he treat Brian the way he does? Is it because Brian deserves it? Like, does Brian have a charisma to himself that makes Frank like him, or is Frank overcoming that?
Do you remember that? To not? One of the things that Prescott seems to admire in his students is the degree of their admiration of him. So Brian's very keen to earn the respect of Prescott in the same way that Charlie was his hound, whereas this other boy was somewhat indifferent. He wasn't willing to earn Prescott's respect at all. So there are various times in the novel where Prescott says things like, you know, they didn't fear me, or he likes to know that he's made an impression on somebody, I think.
So this is more of Frank being Frank.
I would suggest that, I think. Yeah. Because Brian's desperate for Frank's approval all the time.
True. Right. And Frank has confessed to liking that. Yeah. I was hoping it was a place where Frank had grown, but I'm convinced. I think you're right.
Okay.
Well, time for the next question. Sometimes these conversations can feel a little bit abrupt, but this one's from Krista. She says, in reading Jules' memoir, it was obvious that he hated Dr. Prescott. However, Jules' account didn't make me hate Prescott. Is this a flaw in Auchincloss writing, or does it just prove that Jules' hate wasn't actually against Dr. Prescott? It really makes me think that his frustration isn't against Prescott, but against not truly knowing God, similar to Jack and Gilead. So I don't know if you've read Gilead, either of you, the Marilyn Robinson novel. So
you can read American novels.
I need to read that. Everyone's telling me how brilliant it is. I've only read Housekeeping, so I need to read the rest.
You might as well. Might as well, you know, catch up to the last 40 years of her life. Okay, so what do you think about this, though? We'll disregard the Marilyn Robinson reference there. Is it a flaw in Auchincloss writing, or does it prove something about Jules that Jules' memoir doesn't make at least Krista, and I'll throw my hat in the ring on this one, hate Dr. Prescott? Or is it just a flaw in Jules? Matt, I'll let you go first on this one. Or is there another path?
So it would be a flaw if he intended to make us hate Frank by sharing this memoir with us, right? And then because we don't hate Frank, he failed, I guess. Is that the question? Or is she saying, or did he not intend that? And then he's showing us something else about Jules. And Auchincloss didn't intend for us to hate Frank. But he actually is trying to show us something about Jules' hate and Jules' hatred for God or whatever, right?
I think this is where the multi-layered narrative structure can brief to some what we're talking about. Because on the one hand, we have to figure out what was Jules' goal in writing, like the character of Jules, what's his goal in writing? But then we have the author, Auchincloss himself, what's his goal in giving us this thing that his character wrote?
Maybe it's a weird thing, maybe it's not. Maybe everybody thinks this about literature, I don't know. But I have this thing where I think that...
Like a tick? Like you have a...
It's like a tick, yeah. Where I tend to think that a situation like this is actually more, I actually can do more with interpreting myself as the reader than with maybe what Auchincloss was trying to make me think here.
Like you can, by recognizing and sort of seeing your own response to it, identifying it?
Yeah. So it's less about, for me, it's less about whether Auchincloss was trying to make me hate Frank or make me feel a certain way about Jules. And more about revealing to me the kind of person I am and what kind of person I am if I read this and it makes me hate Frank, or what kind of person I am if I read this and it makes me feel a certain way about Jules, right? Mm-hmm. So I would think about it less what Auchincloss's goal was for evoking a particular emotion, and more about what kind of person am I if I based on the reaction I did have. But then I don't know. I'm not answering the question. I just changed it. So that's not fair.
It's a very compassionate response though.
Matt's responses.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's the nicest thing you've ever said. You get a point.
Yeah. See, I was Matt's like, yeah.
To teach someone virtuous behavior.
I may be a lot like Frank. I just want admiration. And
you just want people to give you compliments and tell you that you're better than you are. Is that what's, yeah. Sarah Jane, what do you think? I mean, is the conversation about whether this is a flaw really even, I mean, I don't want to be critical of the question, but is it really the point, I guess?
It's a perceptive question because, and Matt's answer is also right in tune with the question, because essentially it's the same as saying, you know, should we really sympathize with Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost? Because what your listener has recognized is that Jules is the kind of anti-hero of the novel. And there is a human desire, I think, to side with the anti-hero, because it's much easier to get on board with someone who has loads and loads of faults like we do. And I kind of feel a bit better about ourselves for that. But I don't think it's a flaw in the novel. I don't think the fact that Jules's memoir is so critical of Frank makes us, or should make us side with him against Frank. I think what Auchincloss uses Jules's account for is to show Frank's capacity for compassion, forgiveness, understanding. He realizes that Jules is a kind of messed up young man who is really craving something to strive against because Jules is in search of greatness. And I think Frank's response to Jules actually heightens our admiration of Frank and his kind of magnanimous character, that he's able to kind of see through all the manipulation and the tricks and the nastiness of Jules and realize that he should have been kinder to him. And the really bad reflection we get, I think, is of David Griscom, his father, that casts a shadow on David Griscom. But I think it's a really perceptive question because Jules is the anti-hero of the novel very clearly.
Mm-hmm. So that brings up a question. Nicole asks, is there a villain in this book? If so, who and why? I really walked away from the book hating Griscom. Are we supposed to have, I don't know which one she means. Are we supposed to have any sympathy for him at all? Or am I missing something? I feel like he more so than Jules is Prescott's biggest failure. So David Griscom. David Griscom. Ah, so is there a villain in this book? So we're talking about Jules as sort of an anti-hero, but then Nicole brings up this question of a villain. And then there's a little conversation that happens here. And then Nicole says, he just irritated me to no end. I think he did some things with good outcomes, but I think he maybe always had weird motives. Like he just seemed to really miss the mark on how to live. Even the way his house described and how he doesn't seem to have any genuine affection for anything. And he's always manipulating.
Yeah.
So
it seems that's just a clue that Lewis Auchincloss doesn't know how to write men. It just makes David Griscom such a flat character. You know?
Yeah. In comparison to all the complex and sophisticated women.
Exactly.
Somebody does have a comment on here in support of Harriet, by the way. Maybe
I'll amen. Let's get that question on.
So this question of a villain. So, I mean, there's a difference between an anti-hero and a villain. Would we accept that?
Like, yeah, I think so.
Difference of degree, at least.
Yes. But if you ask me what the difference is, I can't tell you. But I know what it is when I see it.
Okay. That's not helpful.
Maybe we're wrong then. Maybe that is the same thing.
But like in contemporary fiction and movies and things like that, an anti-hero is sort of the main character of the book who's not necessarily a good guy, right? Mm-hmm. But we're not talking about that.
But also because he's the main, we have some sort of weird attraction or sympathy. Attraction to him or sympathy for him.
Yeah, and many times that attraction or sympathy that we have to him is meant to be sort of like, that's meant to be the point. That was meant, yeah. You're not meant to like him, but then you do. So then you have to question your own.
When I watched that awful show Breaking Bad and I found myself rooting for him to get away with his meth lab business, mm-hmm. and I'm like wanting him to not get caught. and I have, I'm wrestling with myself over this. Like, why are you rooting for
the bad guy to
get away with it?
Point of the show.
And then I realized, no, it's because I want him to get away with it so that he has more time to repent. So I don't know. Maybe sometimes it's that for the anti-hero. But then with a villain, with an actual villain.
Well, actual villain, you want destruction.
Right.
You want him to be overcome.
Yeah.
So, so I would say, I would be fine with saying it's a matter of degree. But also, I think it's, technically speaking, there's a technical aspect to it. The villain is the one who is the obstacle to be overcome by the hero of our story. Whereas an anti-hero can be the protagonist of the story.
Yeah, not the driving force of the plot.
Okay,
yeah,
right.
Okay. So then let's say that, are we okay with using that definition for the sake of this conversation then?
Sure.
So then let's say that the villain is the person who has to be overcome. Would we agree that that one of the Griscoms, that there is a villain in the story, or is it sort of, you know, non-traditional, non-archetypal in that sense?
Wait, so it's man versus man, man versus nature, man versus God, man versus self, right?
Yeah, so is the villain, Sarah Jane, you want to answer the question?
I'm inclined to say that Dave Griscom is villainous because he is the incarnation of a kind of vacuous materialism, as Nicole recognizes in her question. Mm-hmm. And that is the greatest threat to Justin Martyr and the ideals of Dr. Prescott. So then it becomes a battle of philosophies or ideologies. And I think Nicole is right that Dave Griscom is the embodiment of the kind of pressing modernity that's changing the nature of the school that Prescott tried to create. Mm. And his family are an example of that's going to sound very harsh, but sort of an example of his poor leadership as a father.
What? I think that just sounds true. I don't know that. Can it be harsh if it's true?
But what does that say about Frank then? I mean, his children didn't turn out exactly angelic, and neither did his students.
Cordelia is the one we really get an insight into, but the other two sisters are sort of relatively neutral, aren't they?
Yeah, I think they just say, like, there's no point in talking to them because they're just going to tell you how great he is.
Yeah.
They're just going to defend him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which at least suggests they love him.
It does. Or admire him, if we're going to make that distinction, like he does. I wonder I think my gut reaction would be to agree with you completely, Sarah Jane. Like, I see Dave Griscom as the villain that has to be overcome because of his materialism and because of his manipulativeness. Then secondarily, maybe, or as kind of alongside of it, though, I do feel like there's some sort, and maybe this is in my head now because of the earlier question, but there is something in which I think Frank has to overcome himself or at least overcome this very narrow way in which he's defined what the Justinian is going to be, right?
Frank has to overcome that definition.
Mm-hmm. And it is a definition he created, right? Based on himself. So
does that mean he has to broaden the definition?
I mean, he has to allow for personality, and which he hasn't been, apparently, seemingly hasn't been willing to allow for, and now is, at least with Brian. But then also, what's the other one? Didn't he start tennis club or something like that? I can't remember. Didn't we talk about that? Where he...
Yeah, he
let them play baseball or something.
Yeah, I don't like it when Frank makes concessions. The difficult thing.
Well, we gotta talk about that for a little while.
I'm an idealist, though, and I kind of think his ideals are right, and that the thing that Auchincloss really gets the reader to struggle with in the novel is that without Dave Griscom, the school would probably fail because it would become outmoded and it would be financially dissolute. And so there's this tension where all the idealism and archetypes of Frank are dependent on this thick cut new money of American business, and that you can't have one without the other.
Okay, that brings up a question here that I want to bring up, this question of idealism, because Jamie says this. She compares this book to The Remains of the Day. Have either of you read that? The Ishiguro book?
Yes.
No.
Which we happen to have done on this podcast. But she says, I think even if you don't, even if you haven't heard, you'll be able to answer this question. I think, Matt, you'll be.
I have a question about it. About it after that.
About Remains of the Day?
Well, kinda.
I've met Ishiguro. He came and spoke about how he wrote that novel.
What? No kidding.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I just, it's just, you know, it's Thanksgiving. I'm about to go on a road trip. And I have to choose between that book, Remains. I was thinking about this on the way here. I'm either going to read Remains of the Day or The End of the Affair. Which one should I read first?
You're on a road trip for a holiday, Remains of the Day. That's my vote.
Sarah Jane?
Yeah, if it's between those two, yeah.
It's a road trip book.
With my wife. So The End of the Affair.
No, it's a, I would, and it's also, neither of them are that long. I would say Remains of the Day is a good holiday book.
Okay. Thanks. Sorry for the distraction.
It's a close reads show. We should be giving each other book recommendations. That's in line.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing, right? We've already done Remains of the Day, but we're
going to do The End of the Affair this spring, and I'm going to be sending out the schedule soon. Well, I guess I already sent out the official schedule, but okay. So here's the question. The protagonists in both these novels spend their lives on the implementation and embodiment of a particular ideal with varied results and consequences. In The Remains of the Day, it's a butler who works for a lord, duke, yeah. Something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know the premise of it. So I probably know enough to, well, maybe go on.
Okay. So at the end of the novels, both characters seem to be reflecting and asking themselves in one way or another, was it worth it? And then Jamie says, as an idealist myself, who has made some rather drastic and countercultural decisions in order to live out my ideals, I cannot help but find in each of these novels a sobering reminder that how one chooses to live one's life has profound effects on those living alongside and in light of those choices, for good or for ill. And which one it turns out to be sometimes depends entirely upon whom you're asking. So is this a cautionary tale then?
What would Flannery say about that?
Go on. Actually, was that Andalusia yesterday?
She, it's a great question from Jamie. I'm always cautious of reading texts as a kind of, first and foremost, a didactic lesson in how to behave. Mm-hmm. This is clearly an art form where he's experimented with different kind of almost like a cubist perspective. He's put some mirrors up and tried to create an enigma through his narrative style. So while we probably do inevitably learn things from the characters about our own lives, I would just be careful about reading any novel as a flat lesson on how to live. I think it's more than that. But I haven't answered the question there at all. That was just a school mommy intervention.
Do you want to respond to that, Matt, or do you want to also jump up on the soapbox?
Well, does Sarah Jane want to answer it, or is that you just want to, do you want to stop at this school mommy, okay. Full stop?
Let me, can it be a cautionary, can we read it as a cautionary tale and still avoid doing what you're saying there? Sarah Jane.
Yeah, I think we can learn from it. So the protagonists embody a particular ideal, and then the characters wonder whether that was worthwhile in the end and whether they sacrificed more than they gained, and how does that affect the people around them? I suppose Auchincloss shows us that the ideal that you're striving for has to be true and good and virtuous and robust. Otherwise, yes, ultimately, it's a vaudeville. You're a fake. But if you're trying to emulate, as Prescott is, I think, the virtue of a Christian God, then there's obviously a great reward in that. And even though you're never going to be able to do it perfectly. I find Remains of the Day incredibly sad. Because I think the protagonist of Remains of the Day realizes that perhaps he was pursuing an ideal that no longer exists. Whereas I think there's a kind of hope at the end of Auchincloss's novel that there are things worth fighting for, and that Prescott was fighting for the right things. Mm.
The other thing about Remains of the Day is that the main character is recognizing that he was also working in support of someone else's ideals, and that that may have not been as pure, or in service of things that were as pure as the two of them thought. And so that becomes deeply, not just disillusioning, but like almost psychologically torturing, you know, to wonder what it is that you have inadvertently supported. And I don't know that this book captures that the same way. Don't worry. That's not a,
I feel like you guys are ruining that book for me right now.
I feel like we're really talking around it so we don't ruin it. No, but in this book here, it's not so much what have I accidentally supported so much as what are the risks of working towards of believing in an ideal, and are those risks worth that pursuit?
And what's the collateral damage on the families, on the people around the protagonist, which I didn't really address in my answer.
Yeah. Matt.
I wouldn't call it a cautionary tale. I like the way Hicks describes it, or Hicks, the president, describes it in Hicks' book, that it's a book that asks questions that cannot be answered. And I think it gives us a big question, the one that you guys have just been saying, right? Like, you know, this question about the pursuit of ideals, it can't say whether that's right or wrong, or when it's right and when it's wrong, or what it looks like for it to be right and what it looks like for it to be wrong. Like, it just can present ways that it's been done or ways that it could be done, and then look at, you know, the possible effects of doing it that way, and what happens in that situation to the students, the community, the families, the children, the spouses, the nation, the ideals, the possibility of it all, the impossibility of it all. So, I mean, I don't know what that means for Remains of the Day, not having read it, but I don't know if that same answer works there. I don't know if Remains of the Day is a book that's asking questions that cannot be answered. I don't know. I mean, I like to think so, just if it's a book about idealism, but I don't know if it tries to answer the question. Does he tell you the answers at the end, that it was, would have been better not to have pursued it, or does it leave the questions unanswered? I don't know.
There are sacrifices made. It's difficult to go too much into that question without spoiling the book for you or for any of the other readers. I think in terms of the effects on others, the pursuit of an ideal by, let's say, the father in a family, I think we're given, in a way, as many critical and hostile accounts as possible. Mm-hmm. From various characters in the novel. And yet Prescott still emerges as an admirable character. And he, perhaps Cordelia is one of his greatest critics from the kind of inner circle of people who know him. And I don't think his ideals or his pursuit of them have really ruined her. Perhaps some of her rebellious behavior is because she's trying to gain his attention and he's working too much. But he's so forgiving and helpful. Even when she makes terrible decisions, he keeps intervening. You know, he kind of secures her divorce from her first Catholic husband. He welcomes her back into their home after that and kind of tries to rehabilitate her a bit. I don't think Harriet is desperately unhappy as his wife. Brian is a kind of glowing reflection of some of the great things about Prescott. So I'm not sure that Prescott's effects on others are detrimental. He also kind of rescues Charlie, doesn't he, in a way? And he's spawned a generation of men who are willing to go and fight for their country.
And make lots of money.
And make lots of money for the economy.
I think you make a good point too, because I would have said initially that We see the failures, you know, we see the effects, the results of it on his family and his students and the community, whatever. And yet I think we walk away from the book still thinking that pursuing ideals is worth it. But you take it a step further. You just did it anyways and said, not only that, but that Frank himself is still admirable, even in spite of the failures, right? And I think that's a good point, right? Like, it's not, it's there's something about the pursuit of the ideal that is worth it even in spite of what happens to some of these characters, and that Frank is still worth admiring in spite of what happens to some of these characters.
And his, don't you find him, he has a kind of graciousness in that final banquet, the Jubilee banquet, where he realizes he can't press his idealism anymore, but he, without conceding anything, he just sort of graciously steps down from the stage, says, carry on. I've done what I could.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay. Next question is from Leslie. She quotes Norms and Nobility, where David Hicks writes this. Is Prescott's failure inevitable? What is the solution to the paradox between educating for the world's fight and for the soul's salvation? End quote. So then here's Leslie's question after that. After reading The Rector of Justin, I fall between despair. What's the point of trying to classically educate if it cannot survive the tidal wave of culture? And then faith. God is greater than my shortcomings and failed works, and I'm called to do my best despite the outcome. As mentioned, The Rector of Justin, which is the exact same initials when shortened as The Return of the Jedi, raises more questions than gives answers. And maybe we can at least discuss the big questions quoted above. And did you all find more answers than questions in rereading The Rector of Justin? Although, how does one find more answers than questions? Don't answers depend upon the...
They have to be equal.
Yeah.
at least.
So...
At most.
There's this sort of dichotomy between despair and faith that is coming up in this book. She's saying she kind of vacillates between them. So where do you guys fall on this? The question that she ends up asking is, do you find more questions than answers in this book? And I think one of you just sort of said that the book seems to offer more questions than answers. But, you know, Hicks is asking, is Prescott's failure inevitable? Like, is there a solution between this paradox, between educating for the world's fight and for the soul's salvation? And this, Leslie says, this is sort of a, you know, at times it feels like this dichotomy is, this paradox is sort of despair inducing. Do you feel that way, Matt?
I think if I was looking at education, the goal of education to be that my child or my student or my students are going to take on the world's fight at the world scale, the world level, that my students were going to somehow be responsible or required to have some significant impact, like in the history books, like, oh, this is the day that little Matt Bianco changed the world. Then I would be in despair. But if I look at it because of the way she worded it, I think, I mean, what she says in her question, but if I'm looking at it from the perspective of, can I educate them to abide in their family, their home, their community, their neighborhood, their job in a way that they love their neighbors and they love God, then I don't feel despair there at that level. I feel like it's possible, and the faith part of it, you know, makes it even more so that it's a question of scale for me, at what point I veer towards despair and what point I find myself being more upheld by faith.
That's it. I gotta think about that. So I'm just gonna do that. Sit here and think about it, and I'll let Sarah Jane talk now.
Well,
sounds like I didn't get any points for that, Sarah Jane. I don't think I got any points.
I think it was keeping your answer to give it a mere point. Well, that wasn't a point scoring answer. That was deep. That was profound. And I agree with you. I think if you, your family, and your children are obeying those commandments to love God first and love your neighbor as yourself, then that is engaging in the world's fight. There's nothing else you can do. And the soul's salvation is through engaging in the world's fight. That's what we're called to do as Christians. And And that is, we do kind of fail forward as teachers, I think, and as soon to be parents, I'm sure, with this sense that, I can leave lessons feeling absolute despair sometimes that I haven't taught them anything, or I've modeled something really badly and encouraged all kinds of vices. But that despair is in relationship with faith always, that you always, you know, get up the next day and you do it again and you do it better and you try to do your best. So I think making it a dichotomy between the soul's salvation and the world's fight is a very unhelpful way of dividing this. I think that it's both together, because, you know, the Great Commission is that all authority in heaven and earth have been given to Christ. Therefore we go and we do the work of filling and subduing the world and shining the light of the gospel. And I think that essentially is kind of what Prescott is trying to do, and that it can't really be a retreat into the kind of the bell tower of Justin Martyr, that he has to go out and fight the battles and sometimes lose them in order for this to be affirming of his faith. I think, is that helpful at all? I don't know.
Do you think that he gets that distinction except my distinction about the scale, but I think you were, is he making that distinction, or is he trying to fight it at, trying to train them to fight it at a level perhaps higher than they could be trained for? Like, it's more than just loving their immediate neighbors and family, but almost to the point of neglecting immediate neighbors and family in order to go fight at the level of the UN or something.
I don't know. I think he does preach service and service of your neighbor all the time. And he preaches it in a way that he says, and don't expect any rewards immediately either. And I think that's why he clashes so much with Jules. Hmm. We don't get a lot of detail in the novel about the kinds of things that the boys actually do in service to the community. But that moment sticks in my mind where Prescott is very disconcerted by the fact that the boys aren't queuing for their supper, because they're not kind of, you know, saying, no, sir, after you go and you take your meal first. I'm sure there'll be plenty for me too. And so I think he does try and teach that love of neighbor in a very fraternal sense in the school, in the boys' relationships. And that, again, why he objects to the trot so much is because it's dishonest. The boys aren't serving each other well by cheating or lying. And these little kind of nuances are the things that bother him.
Lizette says this. I think this is related. She says, this book reminded me so much of teaching at a charter school, underserved students. But in the end, schools are institutions, and institutions require several leaders, and with shared responsibilities, there is more acceptance of change. As Prescott School grew, he lost his individual relationship with students and control of his vision. He was no longer the acting god, but the idol. Would Prescott have been more content with a smaller school which still reflected his dream, in which he was not, I guess, had not sort of became the idol? Seems like he speaks to that. Like he says, I'd be, you know, he doesn't want it to become as big as the board of directors pushes it to be. But on the other hand, it would change how people think about him and his reputation. So what do you think? Would he have been content with that, Matt?
Yes, if he had known that the alternative was what happened. Like, I think at some point
if he had enough foresight to see what was.
Yeah, and I think he did, but I don't know if he knew exactly at what point it changes.
Yeah, so later in his life, he's looking back and he's saying, "Well, we made mistakes."
Yeah, but I think he knew beforehand that it was going to change the nature of the school. I just don't know if he knew
what that would mean.
Exactly what that would mean, right? And so I think if he knew better what that would mean, he would have preferred or been happy to have. I think he'd been content, satisfied with the smaller school. I like to think he would, but I don't know why I think that. I mean, I can't point to the text and say, here's why I think that. I just think it. But then it got away from me. Like, I think there's, I mean, at some point, you're you have, you know, you're the thing that you're responsible for, and you want, you're willing and ambitious enough to want that to be bigger.
Because you think you can reach more people, you can.
Yeah. Well, yeah, whatever. Right.
Serve more people.
But at some point you know that it's going to get to a size where you're not actually able to be responsible for it anymore and to care for it anymore. But you don't know where that is, right? Like if you're like, what, you know, in John 10, Jesus says something about, you know, the shepherd will lay down his life. The good shepherd will lay down his life for the sheep, but what does he call his assistants? The assistant shepherd or sheep herders, right? Those people will not, they're there to get their paycheck and move on. Like the goodness of the sheep isn't what matters to them. So in a dangerous situation, they abandon the sheep. But how many sheep can you have before you can't do it alone anymore, that you have to bring in hired hands? And then
those sheep dog, man.
Yeah. And then those people don't, right. And then those people don't care for the sheep in the same way that you do. And I think it's the same thing with the school, with any business, right? At some point it grows beyond the scale that you can personally care for it. And the people who come in to help you can be people who love it the way you do, or they can be hired hands who are there for, you know, some other reason, typically in, you know, capitalism, for capital reasons. But you don't know exactly, is it when I have 98 sheep, 99 sheep, 100 sheep, mm-hmm. 110 sheep? When does that happen?
Yeah.
And so I think he was pushing it to try to find that. And then it went beyond where he might've wanted it to.
Mm. Sarah Jane.
The problem that Prescott encounters with the school getting big is that he does have a personal ambition to be the greatest headmaster in New England. And Harriet discloses this to Brian. Mm-hmm. When Dave Griscom starts pushing for an enhanced kind of admissions process and more students at the schools. So that's one of the tensions in Frank Prescott's character, I think, is that his pride comes in and he does want a bigger school, even though he doesn't sort of publicly confess that. And so in a way, he compromises or sacrifices on his personal relationships and the integrity of and the quality of the school in order to aggrandize his reputation. But I think that's one of the difficulties there, is that I don't think he does it to reach more boys. I think he does it because he's in pursuit of greatness himself. And that's okay, I think, but there is a sense that his ambition his ambition makes the school become something different.
Like it gets away from him.
Yeah, that he's able to abide with it just being small, that he wants to be great.
You're a more honest reader than I am. I appreciate that. Because like you just say what it is, right? Like it says that. Exactly what you just said. The book tells us that. And I'm over here like, no, I think he knows. I think he regrets. I think he was only going as far as he could. And because I love Frank so much, I don't want to say anything bad about him. And you're like, no, actually the book says he's ambitious and he wants to be the greatest headmaster in all of New England. So, and I'm like, no, he's humble and full of humility.
He does learn that in the novel. But I don't know. I'm maybe being a bit flat and literalist reading what it says, and perhaps it does require a bit more exegesis.
No, well, I'm just trying to save the appearances because I want to.
It's so funny that you mentioned this, because Austin asks a two-part question here that I think is worth bringing up. He says, first, do you think that the Close Reads group and listenership in general is at greater risk of misreading or overestimating this particular book because we are more sympathetic to Prescott's ideals than he says than the author is here? But I think we could probably just put an end stop there, because we are sympathetic to Prescott's ideals. So is it possible that we are, I would say that yes, probably anybody who sympathizes with somebody's ideals is at a greater risk of misreading or overestimating a particular book or any work of art or a person in general. So I think probably we are at risk. So then the question becomes, have we done that?
If I hadn't just said out loud
That you do that?
That I'm doing that? And you asked this question before I said that, I would have denied it. No, we're not at greater risk than that. But then I just did it. So now I have to admit it.
Yeah. 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 I guess I kind of walked you into that one a little bit there. That was a little unfair. Sarah Jane, what do you think?
Is Austin calling us to be more cynical in our reading? Or is he suggesting we're being too idealistic?
Not well, critical enough. I think we'd have to ask Austin that question, because I don't know that his question is particularly... I mean, I guess we could read between the lines and say that maybe, but...
He didn't put like
there's no emojis.
Emojis, little hashtag cynicism, go cynicism, or anything like that, so we know. Yeah.
I think there's a subtlety to what Auchincloss is doing, though, as we've discussed already, in that he's giving us critical, hostile portraits and setting himself the challenge of creating an admirable character through that narrative frame. And so I think I actually had to search quite hard to find what it was that was so admirable about Prescott. And I think Auchincloss requires the reader to do that. I think it would be easy to read the novel as a kind of Dave Griscom and see Prescott as the relic, the kind of outmoded, static, brittle idol that needs to be kind of recast or set aside, and you know, onwards into modernity with our kind of factory makers ideals about education, where you get as many in through the door and everybody kind of does the same thing. I don't know. I don't think we've misread it. No. So, maybe that's a bit defensive.
Well, so Austin said, his follow-up question is, he mentions that Auchincloss wrote an essay called Origin of a Hero. And then he says, how should close readers treat commentary provided by an author on their own work? Does taking the work on its own terms mean that we should ignore this kind of extraneous material, or that we should seek it out? And we talk about this concept from time to time over the years on this podcast and on various other sister shows, so to speak. Given that Auchincloss himself wrote an essay of this kind, it might be worth addressing quickly. Sarah Jane, what do you think about this question? And I would say, let's not spend too much time on this, because there's one more question that I want to bring up here that I think is a crucial wrap up question. But
I think it'll be about women.
But it's okay. Maybe there's two then. But it's worth it. But I think it's worth at least addressing quickly. And Sarah Jane, you've never gotten to at least chime in on this particular topic. So what are your thoughts on?
I have never chimed in on this question.
On any other thing that we've ever done. Yeah, sure.
Anything ever done.
how should close readers treat commentary provided by an author on their own work? Does taking the work on its own terms mean we should ignore this kind of extraneous material, or that we should?
May I ask some questions about demography before I answer that? Are you and your listeners mostly in the South, in America?
I would say we are mostly in America, but I don't know that we are mostly in the South.
Not mostly in the South.
But okay. we are in the South currently.
Yeah.
The new criticism came out of the South.
Yep.
So I can see where there would be a kind of an allegiance to that. The idea that, you know, you could pick up a poem off the floor and you don't need to know who wrote it or when. And you just deal with a text for its own sake. And you can still get a full appreciation of its beauty and its meaning and everything else. I think there's nothing wrong with that. But if there's more material available, why deny yourself more insight, context, especially when the writer is telling you something about his intentions and his artistic vision? I'm a kind of maximalist. I would say, give me as much as possible. I'll just keep reading.
Because we're not gluttons, Sarah Jane. It's moderation. That's why we deny ourselves.
I'm an Epicurean.
An Epicurean reader. You got to write a book about that. That's brilliant.
Give me all of it, and then I'll have the dessert wine and the handmade chocolates and everything else. The 10, 11, 12 courses.
So then are you suggesting that the John Crow Ransoms and the Robert Penn Warrens and whoever else was in the, the new critics. Alan Tate, are you saying that those people were just gluttons for punishment then?
I think there was a political reason for their kind of austerity and their discipline about isolating the text, because it was to do with saying, look, I don't need to have a top degree in literature or theology from Harvard in order to be able to read a poem, which is fair enough. I agree with that point. But if, you know, if you're capable of deepening your understanding, enriching your learning and finding out more, then why not? Why stubbornly kind of stick to that sort of isolationist policy?
All I know is that in this community of readers and listeners, that if you
what are you about to say?
If you talk about a book and you have an interpretation of that book and you quote that author who the author has written elsewhere in affirming your view, and the person you're talking to agrees with you, then there will be this overwhelming approval of going to the author's external outside sources as for writings. But if you quote it and it's affirming your view and the person disagrees with that interpretation of the book or the story and disagrees with the author's own interpretation of the story, then the response will always be something like, we all know that even authors don't know the meaning of their own work. and then they'll quote an author who said that to prove the point.
Well, here's the thing about this though. So the act of reading is an extremely different creative act than the act of actually writing.
Agreed.
And so, like, you think about, so there's the famous story of Flannery O'Connor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Graham and I were working on a feature about Andalusia, her home farm, for the winter issue of the Forma magazine that we published. And so they, at the museum that is her house right now, they actually have a display in there where they have a bunch of black hats that belong to her mother and her, and they've got them all on display, like 30 of them or something like that. And they relate the famous story where she's giving a lecture at a college and the young man says, he's got all these theories about what the black hat on the misfit represents. And O'Connor says, he's asking her, I need to know what the black hat represents in this story. It represents something, right? And she says, she's like, well, in the South where I live, most of the men wear black hats. He's like, no, but it represents Christ or the devil.
It's
or like,
the sun off your head.
Right. And she's like, in this letter, she writes, he went away very disappointed in me. And it's like it ruins this person's estimation of her vision as a creator. Mm-hmm. And for her, she's not necessarily trying to capture some archetypal concept or metaphor when she does this. She's trying to capture something that was true to life. But the thing is, on the other hand, I think you can also make a case that things get beyond.
Yes.
Like the creative act takes things beyond what the author's like intended to create.
Is an archetype, whether we're aware of it or not, right? And so it ends up being put into the story without even realizing why it's being put into the story as an archetype.
Well, I also would say that in O'Connor's case, even if she didn't mean to, she's speaking into a tradition that has been manifesting meaning through images as long as stories have been told. So on the one hand, there's that case. And then on the other hand, she could be trying to subvert that, you know?
Yeah. Against that extreme symbolist imagist movement.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So both of those things can be true. And then on the other hand, I think that I think you can make the case that she's being comically obtuse when she makes a comment like that to a kid, like that she's basically going above and beyond what she actually believes. Like, my suspicion is that she would say, yes, there is this tradition, but also, like, if you read that way, I think what she's saying to that young student is, if you read that way, according to this, you know, this imagist movement, as you said, then you're going to be miss the forest for the trees. Mm-hmm. And so I think she's being extreme in the way she approaches that. So people say things, including authors, say things about their own work for various reasons. And I think you need to take we generally need to take those things that they say with a grain of salt, because every time someone says something about their work, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, there's many reasons why someone might say something in a lecture or to in a letter to somebody, or they might contradict themselves. And that doesn't mean that when if they interpret their own work in two different ways, it doesn't mean that they don't know what their work is about or what they were trying to do. Or, you know, sometimes people change their minds about things or they've got different contexts in which they're saying it. Mm. So, you know, I think that I agree with what you're saying, Sarah Jane, in as much as, you know, I think there is value in sort of being an Epicurean reader, right? As you put it, that there is value in reading as much as you want about that an author says about things. But also it doesn't mean that, that, you know, everything that they wrote was inspired or that they even know them themselves too well, or that, you know, they might change their mind. And so I think that like there is a sense in which we can trust an author too much about what they think their actually work is going to mean to people throughout history. Because
I think, sorry, go on.
Well, I was just, I climbed up on my own soapbox, but all I was going to say is I was going to conclude that by saying what they say matters, but also the way a work takes on its own life throughout the centuries is unpredictable.
What they say matters insofar as they agree with my interpretation, I think is what it boils down to. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, no, that's not what I'm saying, just to be clear. Because I don't think that it's about interpretation. I think it's about the way a work fits into centuries of tradition. And that is unpredictable.
Mm. I mean, I'm nodding like my head instead of saying words.
There's a certain poetry in the way that a book takes on its own life in the tradition of literature throughout history. Okay, Sarah Jane, go ahead.
I think Sarah O'Connor, she writes a lot about humility, and I agree with the kind of direction of the reader's, Austin's question, which is, you know, we want to avoid a kind of intellectual snobbery, which is, well, I've read Auchincloss's essay about his own work and actually says this, so I have a superior understanding of the novel to you because, you know, you haven't done your background reading. I think that's the wrong kind of attitude, obviously, but I think if you're interested and you've read the book and you want to know more and you've got time, then there can be a lack of humility in saying, you know, no, actually, I'm not going to read anything else about it because I'm happy with my own opinion about it. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah. I need.
Yeah. So you kind of need to have a humility to the text. And then also just remember that, our opinions can be wrong and we can learn something more by reading around. I just looked up Auchincloss's essay, Origin of a Hero, and I got She-Ra, Princess of the Power, which is a British, maybe you didn't have that in America, I don't know, but it was a British cartoon about a heroine when I was little. So
yeah, we had that when I was little.
Yeah.
It was He-Man and She-Ra, yeah.
So I hope that isn't what's behind the text, because that would drastically change my opinion of the whole thing.
Yeah, see, be careful, right? You dig deeper at your own peril.
And just don't use Google. It's useless.
The Epicurean reader now has to watch that cartoon just to make sure they can understand what this book's about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think you're right though that you know, if we just count on ourselves, then we're both limiting ourselves and probably thinking too much of ourselves. I think that's what you're trying to say, right?
I think that's what she's saying. So I'm going to answer for her. Yes, I think that's what she's saying. Good job.
Yeah.
According to my interpretation of what Sarah Jane said, that's what she was saying. What she thinks she was saying doesn't matter.
Unless it agrees with what you're saying.
Unless it agrees with what I'm saying.
So we're going to need to look at her letters after the pod. Like in a year, we'll look back at the letters that she sends.
Right. I think though that I think when we read Auchincloss's essays, those become a part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. But I think what we tend to do is take those and make them authoritative in a way that
beyond the book, like they go above the book in the hierarchy.
Right. They go above the book in the hierarchy. And then the experience of the book with myself and the tradition, the larger story. So then we almost don't even need to read the book. We know what the book's about because he told us in this essay. I don't know if he actually says that in the essay. I haven't read it, but I'm just saying hypothetically. And when it should be just another part of the conversation in the same way, not in the same way, but kind of in the same way that this podcast is a part of that conversation, mm-hmm. right? Like I'm not authoritative on, you know, anything I've said here is not authoritative on how the rector of Justin should be understood and read, but it, hopefully it becomes a part of a person's conversation about it, right? With the text.
Yeah. Although what Sarah Jane says, we'll take as authoritative.
Most of the time.
Because she teaches at Eton.
And because of an accent.
An accent, yeah.
So then... If we, it's like
I just swooned. Yeah. Just the accent. David, can you just sell insults on me?
You'll be fine. You're better than, you know. Okay. So if we're trying to visualize this, then let's imagine, can we imagine that the tradition itself is a giant whiteboard or a blackboard? What do you guys call them in England? Chalkboards, blackboards, whiteboards. What do you use?
Dry erase boards.
I use an iPad Pro. Sorry.
Okay. So
my gosh.
So terrible.
So we're going to go with, we're just going to go with a big giant chalkboard. Okay. Let's imagine it's a giant chalkboard. And that's the tradition. And along that tradition are, along that blackboard are a bunch of parallel lines. So are the...
What is this analogy?
Okay, hold on. I'm just trying to...
Is that a Blondie album?
Google it. Okay. So just help me out here. I'm trying to think through this.
Okay.
So
sorry.
When we're thinking about the nature of the tradition, you have troublemakers, rabble rousers, are the extraneous stuff, as Austin puts it, say it's a book of letters or essays that they write or lectures they give or interviews that are given with an author. Are those things one parallel line that run parallel to, say, the works of writers? So, I mean, obviously with something like Homer or Shakespeare, we don't have that separate track. We don't have that, you know, Shakespeare didn't write essays about his own work that we have anyway, which actually, now that I'm thinking about, may be the model that all writers should just go ahead and take. But if it was good enough for Shakespeare and Homer, right? So then is one track the works themselves, and then parallel with them is the extraneous material, and we should see them that way within the tradition? Or is the tradition the books themselves, and then outside of the tradition is the extraneous material? Or
David, what would your father say about this very Enlightenment linear approach?
Well, that's the question I'm asking.
your father would draw this as a triangle, and at one end of
with
the triangle,
concentric circles as well.
Exactly. One angle of the triangle would be the author and his circumstances. Another angle on the triangle would be the artifact itself, mm-hmm. and its interaction with the world that it's going through, right? Not mm-hmm. just yeah. when it was written, but as mm-hmm. it's passed through since then. Mm-hmm. And then the other corner would be the reader, and then the reader's mm-hmm. personal circumstances.
I think that's what Dorothy Sayers would do too. But I like the blackboard with the parallel lines. So I'm sorry for derailing that. I was just being obnoxious.
Yeah, I'm a little offended you called. You accused me of being
enlightenment. That was
being
harsh.
Enlightenment.
I
know.
I feel some sympathy. Sarah Jane's kind of the anti-hero now. I think of this episode. Just
Not the villain. Not the villain.
No, we don't need to overcome.
But what would I be in the triangle?
I got nothing.
The reader.
I don't mean it to be like linear in that sense. I'm trying to think in terms of what is the interaction between, I mean, do you think that the triangle, I mean, I know Dad he talks about this triangle thing.
Middle of the triangle is the logos.
But I wonder
all of those things are.
But I wonder sometimes if he's just trying to, he uses a triangle to avoid being enlightenment.
So Sarah Jane can't come along and say, very enlightenment chalkboard you have there.
Yeah, it's very, very linear of you. Because, I mean, the concentric circles is maybe, to me, when you talk about concentric circles, there's too much that's outside of the circles that you then have to debate about. Like, if you have concentric circles, you're trying to find the place where these things all interact, right? Mm-hmm. But then you're just saying that there's things that are outside of the circles where they don't interact. And that, to me, just causes a whole new set of questions that is problematic, or at least raises a new conversation that we don't have time for here. So I was trying to say, what are the things that I was trying to go with parallel lines, I guess, not because of the linear nature of a parallel line, but because of the nature of the relationships between the things.
But lines are an archetype, and that
that's fair.
The significance of that archetype came through the symbols, whether you intended it to or not. Even though I actually we accept this criticism. Do draw parallel this lines is
fair.
On cardboard.
This is fair
in the South,
but
while wearing black hats,
this is that's a fair criticism, and yet I'm limited by the scope of language.
Are you trying to see if there's like what the hierarchy would be though? Like,
okay, so that's what that was my next question, because we sort of think of things in this sort of hierarchy, right? Like that was the question that got brought up a minute ago. Is the hierarchy the books at the top? Where is the author in the hierarchy? Where is the extra thing that the author writes? And what happens if the author contradicts him or herself? So then, given that the author at times is going to contradict him or herself, then it would seem that the book has to go above those things. But maybe then the hierarchy itself is a flawed way of looking at things in the first place. So maybe a parallel lines is a better approach, is what kind of where I was going to go.
What if we visualize those parallel lines as a kind of musical score, and we'll put a treble clef and a bass clef at the start, and then you have all the other kind of little bits of information as notes in this tune of the text, and what we're looking for is a kind of harmony, and maybe the main strain of the tune is the book that we're reading, and then above and below it we have high notes and low notes, and sometimes they harmonize and sometimes they don't, and it's kind of...
So is the book the melody?
Yeah, and you're trying to listen for the harmony with other things outside of the text related to it that chime with it, and if they do, that's great, and if they don't, then maybe, you know, maybe they don't belong there. But
That doesn't sound right.
I don't know. I think you kind of have to. No,
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Nonsense.
No. I'm just kidding.
That was so neoclassical.
Yeah. No, I actually kind of that works. It works better for me than the whole concentric circles thing, and the hierarchy, and it speaks to the sort of experience of like the way we experience a work of literature.
The problem is, I just read that Caldecott book,
Beauty and the Word.
Truth's Sake.
Oh, Beauty for Truth's Sake, yeah.
Yeah, and it's all about the harmony of the cosmos. So.
Well, the harmony thing, I think, is helpful too, because it also helps us to see that sometimes what might immediately, at least, appear to be discordant could... If we could raise ourselves to another level and kind of transcend it for a moment, open ourselves to more information, to more conversation, to more contemplation, we might find that actually the discord isn't discordant, that it's a greater harmony. There's a greater harmony with it. Kind of like the Melkor story, you know, in Silmarillion. Do you read British literature?
I hardly read anything. I just watch television all day, play violent video games.
So that's interesting. The idea of harmony is interesting too, because essentially what we're trying to do here, when we say what we're trying, you know, what the student does when he goes to Flannery O'Connor and asks this question, is he's trying to harmonize some sort of dissonance with it. You know, he's trying to resolve a dissonance or find a harmony within his own questions. Mm-hmm. And so I like the musical analogy because it speaks to what we are all trying to do when we turn to an author's writing, or when we have discussions about a book, or when we listen to a podcast where people, you know, try to rewrite the entire course of literary criticism over the last 200 years, or summarize it into one analogy. But so the harmony
on
is
a blackboard, no less.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
not on an iPad Pro.
I mean, I do feel like, yeah. I don't know what you guys just distracted me, but
sorry.
What, you know that story about Ray Bradbury, right? Where he went to, was it Stanford or UCLA or something, and he was talking to a college, a college freshman English class or something, literature class. And he's talking to them, and then they do in Q&A or whatever, they start telling him that his book is about, that Fahrenheit 451 is about censorship.
Yeah.
And he says, no, it's not. And they proceed to argue with him what his book's about as he's telling them what it's not about. The way I always
imagine that story is that they think he's messing with them, the students.
Probably.
Yeah. Because the critics have decided this is what the book is about, and thus it is about. They've been taught that for so long.
And it says it right on the cover of the book. It says, and on one of the editions, it says, you know, the world's greatest book on censorship or something like that.
You know, it's funny because last night, Graham and I, we went to see a movie called Jojo Rabbit, which it says afterwards, I was reading about it, and it says on all the posters, an anti-hate satire. And I was like, That's not what this is about. But like the marketing decided that's what to put on the cover.
Yeah.
Because it's a troubling concept. This little boy has an imaginary friend who's Adolf Hitler. And he's like in Hitler Youth. And so it's a troubling story, and they don't trust people to get that it's satire.
Huh.
So they have to put on the cover it's anti-hate,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So anyway.
I see. But that's what Flannery O'Connor says as well, isn't it? You know, the whole story is the meaning. Otherwise, we get reductive. And we can change a whole film or a book into, you know, this. The message of this poem is this.
Mm. Yeah.
And they're not really about messages.
Yeah, very few people set out to make a message, you know, to make a story about a message, which brings us to this final question I need to ask. Reed asks, how does Justin Martyr exemplify or not exemplify what good education should look like? And is Prescott a good mentor to emulate? I want to kind of do this as a final thoughts thing. So what I want to do is ask each of you to come up with one thing, one way that Justin Martyr, the school, not necessarily this book itself, but one way that Justin Martyr exemplifies or does not exemplify what good education should look like. Not because I think that this is a book that is trying to teach us lessons at the outset, but because as a book about education being read by educators, it's still worth saying, what have I discovered or what am I thinking about? How has it made me think about what a good education should look like, even if we don't necessarily want to assume that Auchincloss is telling us that there is one way to do education? Mm-hmm. I think it's at least an interesting question to kind of follow up on the conversation we've just been having about, in which I was accused of being an enlightenment, pro-enlightenment, and at the end of a conversation about...
It was a spurious accusation.
I think you got negative points for that one.
I'm just saying. I'm fine because she just accused herself of making a spurious
double accusation. Points. Double
so,
points.
Yeah. You're back up, yeah. Matt, what do you think? How does Justin Martyr exemplify or not exemplify good education?
I'll go first, but Sarah Jane, you can't copy my answer. You have to come
okay. Okay. Well, you can't steal what I'm thinking.
Okay. All right.
So we probably shouldn't be on the same
three.
Then.
On three, we'll say at the same time. No, Matt, go ahead.
I think it's the fully integrated aspect of life at Justin Martyr that is education. Like I think for many of us, we can think of education as this thing where you go learn these specific skills or these specific bits of information, and it's separate from the religious life, it's separate from, or the spiritual life, it's separate from the physical life, it's separate from everything, manners, work, all of that stuff. And at Justin Martyr, what you get is a fully integrated life where learning math, learning reading and writing, learning science, is all of those things are integrated with God, with physical fitness and activity, with the way you line up to go into to eat lunch, with the chapel, with prayer, with how you behave during reading time back at the, what do they call them? Barracks? No, dorms, whatever the house, where you sleep, your sleeping quarters,
barracks,
all of those things, right? Everything is fully integrated there. And the whole life is an integrated life. And I think it's embodied in the school itself throughout the course of the text, the book, but also in those scenes where we get those glimpses of how he led his classroom, how Frank led his classroom, right? Where even just in the conversation, he's trying to integrate, history and theology and philosophy and ethics and life and all of those things, right? So I think that's my one thing.
Sarah Jane, do you have something different?
Slightly. I think what Justin Martyr gets right is actually what we should, as the whole society should get right, which is that worship and rest come first and everything flows out of that. So Joseph Piper's essay, or Piper, I should say, Leisure, the Basis of Culture, argues that front and center of any flourishing society or community of people would be Sabbath rest and temple worship first, and everything else flows out of that. And I think that is what we see at Justin Martyr. They start the day with chapel and they have Sunday chapel and Sunday rest. And that is the kind of, that's the priority. And all the other things they do are in light of that or downstream from that. And I think if worship is done well and faithfully and with an earnest heart, then all the activity that comes out of that rest is productive and good. And that's why it's such a kind of sacrilegious thing for Jules Griscom to lock Prescott out of the chapel and to attack the chapel and to attack the picture of Phillips Brooks as well. And why that's why Jules Griscom understands it's so important to attack the centrality of worship at Justin Martyr in order to impact it downstream.
It impacts it's attacking first things.
Yeah, exactly. But I'd recommend that people ask the article or essay or apologia, if you like, of Leisure. I think it's superb reading for people involved in education.
That's a
Epicurean.
All right. Well, this has been another great conversation. It's amazing how long we've gone on each of these episodes. It's just plenty to talk about. I don't know. Maybe I'm just losing control, or I don't know.
Well, I do want to say that I'm sorry if Sarah Jane and I got a little out of hand on this episode.
Yes. And apologies.
We hope you won't keep us from being on the show together again. Like, won't punish us.
You mean like I feel attacked and feeling defensive? And are you accusing me of being thin-skinned?
I think what really needs to happen, David, is you need to play more football in the snow.
More football in the snow. Well, not Thanksgiving so is coming, so
sitting with Harriet reading poetry. Henry James.
I didn't give you a chance to, you know, I didn't pitch you against one another on the women in this book. But there is always, you know, you could always argue about it over email and we could publish it online.
If there was, Sarah Jane, there was somebody who posted on Facebook saying that...
that they liked Harriet, yeah.
Yeah, that they liked Harriet, that they were with me on liking Harriet and they wanted us to talk about that. But
okay, well, if that makes you feel better about it, then you need to go looking outside of yourself for answers.
Wow. Well, let's end on that. Sarah Jane, thank you so much for joining the podcast for the last last several weeks on this show. And then of course, The Place, The Thing. We are excited that you'll be back at least a couple times over the course of the next year. You are, your baby is due January 19th?
January the 5th.
I went the wrong direction. My wife's birthday is the 12th. And I remember thinking it's 7 days. Days different than her birthday, but I went the wrong way.
Mine's the 19th.
Oh, my yours
is the 19th. Oh,
okay.
And
I definitely remembered that.
And Sarah Jane promised that if the baby's 2 weeks late, she's going to name the baby after me. At least that's how I remember it.
We had a discussion about this.
Taya, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Have you settled on a name?
No, I'm still thinking.
You got time.
I've got time. Yeah.
Well,
I've got ridiculous names, which will never be approved by my parents or my husband.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. Mm. Well, I think that means that the next time we hear from you on the podcast, or at least the listeners hear from you, at least according to the current schedule, that means that you will have a baby, hopefully crying in the background. So
isn't that incredible? Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
What I'm really hoping will happen is that I'll go into labor while your father's here visiting me. Because I just think his schedule isn't action-packed enough already.
And yeah.
Just a bit more stuff to do.
Yeah. Huh. That would be an adventure for you. not that I'm, you know, I want to throw my, you know, I don't mean to be throwing my father under the bus as a, you know, aid in caring for babies. He's been around quite a few of them over the last, well, I guess exactly. 33 years of his life, but
7 grandchildren or more, hasn't he?
Yeah. I think it's 7 now. Yeah. So I don't know if there's any more coming. So presumably not at the moment, but, that's pretty exciting. We're excited for you. And, we are excited, you know, to have you on the podcast and also, you know, hear how things are going with the baby. And that's a grand adventure, I suppose. It's better than the adventure of being on podcast with us. Let's just put it that way. So I guess the next thing we are doing here on the podcast on Close to Reads is we will be discussing A River Runs Through It. So we'll start that next week. And then after that, we're going to do A Piece Like a River. And then we'll get into the new books for the new year. So if you want to see that list or you haven't heard what those are going to be, you can sign up for the newsletter, check out all of our, announcements on social media. And then also we have the announcements for the plays, the thing, the four or five plays we're doing in the plays, the thing coming up as well. So be on the lookout for all that great stuff. In the meantime, happy Thanksgiving to everyone who's listening. We are certainly thankful to everyone who supports the show through Patreon or by spreading the word or just by listening. We are very grateful for this community and to be able to have these lengthy conversations about books with you. And we would not be able to do it, of course, without you. So thank you. And thanks to you, Matt. Thanks to you, Sarah Jane, for joining the conversation. For the Rector of Justin, for Sarah Jane, for Matt, for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks for listening and happy reading.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.